And I always told everybody that if Vincent Yarbrough had Ron Slay's basketball IQ, he would have been an NBA All-Star. But with Hub, do you think that he's got a little Vincent Yarbrough in him where he's really just kind of lackadaisical?
Let me give you this, speaking of the Jerry Green years, and we're going to go back to 420s. And Griff, I'll throw that question that he threw at you about Yarbrough, and we'll kick that around for a second. The last time two players had 25 in the same game, 99, Harris 29, and Yarbrough 25. Griff, what about the Yarbrough comparison to Hubs 3, the naturals, I'm going to start calling him, with the red hair?
Well, first of all, they're very both highly rated players and great talent. But when you watched them, they played with such ease that you thought that they were being lazy.
Yep.
And I think it's hard for me to really speak on Yarbrough since it's been so long that he's played. But with Hubs, I do think that he does take some time off. And that's the one beef I have against him right now is he's still working on his conditioning, so I'll give him that. But he takes some plays off, and you can't take off on defense at all.
That's a really great point. Not to speak over you, Mark. I'm sorry. That's a really great point because Yarbrough, Vincent used to do that, but he had four or five other All-Americans that could pick up the slack. So you know he'd lead the team in scoring a couple nights, and then he'd just disappear. You know, and Tony Harris or Isaiah Victor or Slay or
God, they were so talented.
Would take over. But it just seems like if Hubs could be a guy that would take this team on his shoulders, and it may not be his personality, this team could go a long way. And it's weird because I am pissed. I am flat out pissed off at Barnes recruiting. So let that be known. But I actually think we may have a guy that can develop some lower ranked players when that should have been what happened with Konzo Martin. And it did happen some with Donnie Tindall, but we didn't get a good sample size. But so I'm pissed that Barnes can't recruit with Mississippi State right now in Alabama. But I kind of have a glimmer of hope, thinking that, you know, this guy's a good basketball coach. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you, MP. Great phone call. Griff, your thoughts on him saying that he's disappointed in the recruiting, but he's seeing it so far on the developmental side? Because that's where I'm at. Can I say that and have a seat at the table, or are we both out of bounds?
Well, I'm shaking my head too, Tony, as far as the recruiting end, because if he had so much success at Texas, you would think that there would be a couple four-star, five-star players that he was already recruiting, already had relationships with their high school coaches and their AAU coaches, that he could bring them based on his relationship over to Tennessee with him. Because you go to a school, Tony, based on the coach for the most part. And at least that's my experience. That's most of my colleagues' experience, the former student athletes, is you go because of the coach. And if he's got all these contacts, you would think that a lot of those names would come up. So I'm a little perplexed on that end as well, but I am very pleased how he has coached up the players that he does have. It shows that he can coach. But yeah, I'm a little mystified on the whole recruiting end and why aren't we in on more four or five star players. I would agree.
Keith, can I say that I'm disappointed in the recruiting, but I'm pleased with what I've seen early in the season, and have a seat at the table, or am I an alarmist and overreacting?
Well, I think I put it this way: people complained about not signing Abdulado and not signing Braxton Blackwell. Jalen Johnson's better than either one of those guys, and so's Quay Parker. So,
yeah, and I've seen Ado play, Tony, and yes, he's gone to Mississippi State, and his stock really went down, and I'm not, you know, some recruiting analyst. I'm just telling you from what I've seen on the circuit, because I saw him play. I mean, he was with the Georgia Stars and hardly got off the bench to play with them. Braxton was, I think, better his freshman year than he was his senior year. But nonetheless, I wish both of them that they play well and they do well for their schools. But they just did, both of those individuals just did not develop. Now, would it be nice if Tennessee had signed them? That's Coach Barnes' call. He saw something in both of those players. I just don't think they developed and had the motor, which is the hot topic, a hot word that these people are looking at now, is do you have a motor? And these two individuals did not exhibit having a motor throughout the summer circuit.
Bonus points for using the term individuals. Griff, I will come to you for a final thought here on the way out. Great job by you.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. Hatfield, it's great to be on the air with you anytime, Tony.
Hey, Griff, happy Thanksgiving to you. Give me a final thought to take away from tonight's game, and then I'll throw to Hatfield and do the same. And I want to thank all the great callers tonight, all the wonderful listeners. Continue to spread the word for us, and also our wonderful sponsors, and we'll continue to do this. What some are in cyberspace are referring to as a labor of love. And I'm going to retweet the photograph of the young ladies with Roger. And you can see the look on Roger's face. Roger is giving you... Roger looks like a sort of a... an interesting version of kind of a... He kind of looks like Butch Jones with that haircut from afar. It's pretty darn cool looking. Let's, without further ado, go ahead, Griff, lay it on me. Give me a couple final thoughts, takeaways here.
Final thoughts is that the people that I sat with tonight really seemed to be into the game. It was very entertaining as far as the style of play, which is what Coach Barnes has said, up-tempo. I would really like to see more fans come out and watch this team play and be entertained because they don't hold their head low. They are really playing hard, and it would just be encouraging for the fans that we've got great Tennessee fans for them to come out and back this team.
Thank you, Mark. Great. That's a great thought by Griff. Thank you, Griff. Hey, Griff, happy Thanksgiving, buddy. Keith Hatfield, go ahead, buddy.
Oh, I think one thing you take away from tonight is this team's making some progress. Now, they've still got obvious holes, and we'll get a really good indication of how much progress they've made this weekend, because you're going to play a really good Atlantic King contender, and then you're going to play either a top 25 Cincinnati team or a Nebraska team that's kind of similarly situated to Tennessee as far as rebuilding a little bit. So they'll have two big challenges this weekend, and we'll have a pretty good idea going into the exam period break of where this team is.
Hey, Keith, great job, man. And you were presented tonight by?
Friends at Clancy's Tavern and Whiskey House in downtown Knoxville, next to the historic Tennessee Theater.
And by?
And the Crown and Goose in Knoxville's Old City.
And they are two? A drinking stop.
Yes.
What do you call them? Watering?
Watering holes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hatfield, thanks, buddy. I love you.
Okay.
Hey, Keith.
Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving. I'm very, very happy that you're a part of what we do here, and I'm looking forward to you getting your just desserts as we move into television with this. I think it's gonna be a great thing for you, man.
Well, I appreciate that, Tom. I appreciate the kind words.
Thank you. Always enjoy it. Thank you, Keith.
All right.
I want to thank the living listener tonight. I want to thank our advertisers. I want to say to you, hey, it's great to get wins. We're feeling good. We're riding high. Things are looking up. Tonight, to me, was the best win of the year. This team's been very fun to watch. That was a couple hours well spent. Well, actually, about 3.5 from the game to now. And I went for Mark Griffin, for Bino, for Keith Hatfield. This is Tony Basilio saying Tennessee 95, Army 80, your Tennessee basketball Volunteers, my good friends, improved to 4-1 on the year. Friday night, 9:00, George Washington. Yes, it is televised. And as Freddie Miller, all those years ago on the Superstation, once said, when the game ends, there. again, everybody. Hey, we love you, okay?
Get a copy of Rebuilding Year. John, on the way out, and I really appreciate your time, go ahead and have the final word here about your project. Got a special treat for you here today on Book Corner. Tony Basilio, along with you, as now we're joined by Jonathan Bernstein. He, along with Lori Majewski, they co-authored a book called Mad World, an oral history of the new wave artists and the songs that defined the 1980s. And Jonathan, it is great to have you with us today. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Jonathan, one thing that was tough for me when I picked your book up to get over was you talk about new wave artists, and I found myself thinking, some of these artists aren't what I would consider to be new wave artists. Have you encountered that as the book's been out now for a little bit?
Your reaction and my reaction are identical. You know, the book's just come out in Britain where new wave meant something kind of different. New wave was just a term that disc jockeys and journalists used when they didn't want to say punk rock. But in America, you know, it's kind of a big tent term. You know, it goes from, you know, as we people have in the book, like Adam and the Ants and Gary Numan and Duran Duran, but it also would have the Smiths and New Order and Tears for Fears and NXS and people like Madness. You know, so like I say, it covers like synth pop and goth and industrial rock and bubblegum. It's kind of meaningless, like a lot of labels are. But at the time, it was another way of saying new music.
It's hard to fit music, unless it's just real delineated, like some of the thrash and some of the early punk. You can tell the music that you guys talk about in this book, some of the artists that you cover, for instance, the Gary Numans of the world, the Durans of the world, the ABCs of the world, some of that music. You know, I think like an artist like an ABC, there's a little bit of Motown in there. There's a little bit of that new wave stuff. It's interesting. Yeah. Some of these stories, and they're all oral histories, the way some of these groups just sprang up, these are some really amazing stories. Did you realize this before you set out to do this?
In some cases, yes. In other cases, we were completely surprised. I mean, things like you brought up Gary Numan, kind of vaguely aware that he was in a punk band, but he told us this story. He went in with his band to make a record, to make a really cheap record, cheap punk record, and in the studio there was a synthesizer from a previous session that was waiting to be picked up, and he'd never played one before. He went over to it and touched it, and it made a sound he'd never heard before, and that one sound changed his whole outlook on music, and it was just like, we're not making a punk rock record anymore, we're making an electronic record. And if he hadn't touched that keyboard, we would not be saying his name right now. Not only that, it was set to a sound that he told me I could never find that on my own. So whatever the previous group had used it for, it still made the same sound. And like I say, that one sound just kind of changed the direction he was headed in.
Was there an editing process in this? Because I know you ended up with several artists. Can you give me a couple that didn't make the cut that might make the second edition if you decide to do this again?
Yeah. It was one of these embarrassment of riches thing that in the end, I think we were like 13,000 words over. And it's one of these things like, you know, well, what do we get rid of? So sadly, talked to Paul Young, and that didn't make it. We talked to the group Propaganda, I don't know if you remember them, one of my favorite groups, did the song Dr. Mabuse, which was a big UK hit, big European hit. Mm-hmm. That didn't make it in the end. General Public didn't make it in the end. My book wife, Laurie Majewski's favorite artist, Rick Springfield, who clearly is not New Wave. We had a huge fight over this, but she threw this incredible tantrum that he had to be in the book. She interviewed Rick Springfield, and in the end, that had to go as well. So there are like four or five things. Also, Martha and the Muffins from Canada gave me a great interview. Sadly, there's not enough room for them. There were quite a few artists that we interviewed that ultimately didn't make the final edit. Hopefully, for the sequel, we'll be able to give them their due.
Were you surprised that these folks were as forthcoming with you as they were? It seems like it would be nearly impossible to get this many people to cooperate on a project.
The first couple of people say yes kind of gets the ball rolling. We got Duran Duran fairly early on. It helped for other artists to say that Duran Duran, who were like, yeah, maybe the Dispenis Babies band, they'd already given the seal of approval, then it was kind of easier to get other people. But at the same time, it's still weird with the people who said no all the way through the book's history. Like Bananarama, I must have written 12 emails to their management. I'm not saying Bananarama did not want to do it, but I'm saying Bananarama's manager seems to think that his group are on the level of like a Bruce Springsteen or something. because he did not think that his artists should be demeaning themselves to be in this book. There were a few people who said no. The Pet Shop Boys said no, which I kind of understand, because they don't see themselves as an 80s group. Squiddy Polity in Japan, who I both love, both said no, which was a shame. There weren't really that many other outright refusals. There were things that were just in terms of time. Like, obviously, Culture Club should be there. When they were getting close to saying yes, we just have any more time. The same with the Eurythmics. We had Dave Stewart lined up, and then we were so close to our deadline, we just couldn't make it. Nice foundation for the next book, should there be one.
Let me rip off some of the artists that you featured in here with Oral Histories, and you talk about some of their biggest songs. You've got people like Adam and the Ants, Gary Numan, Duran Duran, who you mentioned earlier, New Order, ABC, Devo, Echo and the Bunnymans, Spandau Ballet, The Human League, Heaven 17, Dexy's Midnight Runners, Bow Wow Wow, The Waitresses, The Normal, Kaja Goo Goo, Thomas Dolby, Psychedelic Furs, Depeche Mode, Yaz, Kim Wilde, Howard Jones, Berlin, Flock of Seagulls, Modern English, Soft Cell, Aha, Joy Division, The Smiths, Tears for Fears, OMD, Ultravox, INXS, Thompson Twins, Simple Minds, Animotion, and then you finish up the book with Band-Aid, and then you have an afterword by Moby. And I guess I rattle them off to ask you this. Give me a couple of your favorite stories that appeared in this book.
That's a tall order. It's not a happy story, but I'd say the Animotion story is one of my favorites. And people would even say, well, why are they in that book? But they were there to sum up what we call Last Gasp of New Wave. It was around 85, 86.
Mm-hmm.
That year was kind of coming to an end. It was also a time when like record companies were taking more control again. Because, you know, one of the interesting things about the start of this era was that it was so unexpected. It's partly because MTV, in its infancy, didn't have enough homegrown videos to last 24/7. So they would pluck out all these European videos, which was the reason like people like Adam and the Ants suddenly found themselves with an American audience. So shoot forward like 5 years, a group like Animotion, who were kind of like in the Fleetwood Mac vein, but then their record company decided it could be kind of MTV material. They got them this Obsession song, they changed their look. And like I say, it was interesting because at the start, you had groups like Adam and the Ants, like Duran Duran, who were totally self-driven groups, who totally came up with their own sound, their own songs, the way they presented themselves. And then we shoot forward 5 years, a group like Animotion, who are totally a record company product, totally told what to wear, what to sing, how to present themselves. They never managed to live down that Obsession song.
What's interesting, you say live down. A lot of the Oral Histories in here, I'll prove to you that I read this. A lot of these groups, Jonathan, they say at first, or for the 15 years after they recorded it, a lot of these folks say, man, I really fought the fact that that was my song. Inevitably, people were still turning.